This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org. Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I am your host, Sari Kamen, and today I am in studio with Pierre Chiem. He is the executive chef of Nok by Alara in Lagos, Nigeria, and he's an ambassador for the culinary traditions of Africa, as well as an advocate for responsible tourism. He is the author of Yolele, Recipes from the Heart of Senegal, and also Senegal, Modern Senegalese Recipes from the Source to the Bowl, a James Beard Award nominee for Best International Cookbook. Welcome to the show, Chef Pierre.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm great.
I'm so happy you're here.
Happy to be here.
We're having a little Vouvray Chardonnay left over from the show before us, which is just fine.
This is just fine.
We're happy to take care of their leftovers.
No problem for me at all.
Okay, good. So you're from Dakar in mm-hmm. Senegal, and I know that's a huge part of your life, and actually it's probably the center of your whole sort of culinary world. What was growing up there like for you?
Growing up in Dakar was awesome. It was like a childhood without... I would say a dream childhood in a way. Dakar is like a coastal city. It's like a perfect weather year-round. It never rains until maybe 2-3 months out of the year. The rest of the year you expect a beautiful weather. For the food part, I would say the African foodie city by excellence. You know, we have great ingredients. You know, we're south of the Sahara Desert, so we have lots of grains in our diet, lots of seafood because of the coastal geography, our location, and also lots of so many different influences because Dakar happens to be a hub for the entrance of Africa. It's the most western coast of Africa, so we have all these different cultures that arrived in Dakar over the centuries. We were colonized by the French. At some point, the Portuguese were there. We have, of late, a Vietnamese community. And all these different communities each brought their culinary experience, their culinary tradition with them. So in Dakar, you have all these great flavors. Growing up in Dakar was a bit of all of that, eating great food, having wonderful weather, great ocean, all the time by the beach.
Why would you ever leave? it does sound like a dream.
It totally is. I go back quite often.
But what was the reason you left in the first place?
Well, the reason I left was I was a student in the late 80s in Dakar, a physics and chemistry student at the Dakar University, Charcot Diop University. And that year, we had what you call an année blanche. Année blanche is a translates in French as a...
White year,
but more like a blank year. We had so much strikes that year, like the school strikes, the student movement is pretty vocal in Senegal. Everyone is very political. So particularly that year, the school movement, the student movement went on strike for a long amount of time. So the government decided to cancel the year because we didn't put enough...
The students went on strike for long enough that the government canceled school.
The government canceled the school.
That's the first. Every American child's dream.
Well, it was a nightmare to us.
I'm sure, not to trivialize what you went through, but...
It really was a nightmare.
I'm amazed that can happen.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it was a first, you know, in my childhood. I never had to deal with this. And But it was a nightmare because we had to deal with starting over a whole new year, even though, you know. And so for me and so for a few other classmates of mine and Senegalese of that year, we were able to get student visas because we didn't want to start a new year. So we wanted to continue our studies. And my student visa was for a school that's located in a town called Berea in Ohio.
Oh, I know it well.
You do?
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
For real? Okay. Well, that's where I was going.
Oh my gosh, it is so different than Senegal.
And New York, I bet, right?
Yes.
Completely different.
It is. It's probably diametrically opposite in every way you can imagine. Did you go there?
Well, I didn't. I got my visa, right?
You're not missing much, I have to say.
So I heard.
Yeah.
So I heard. I was determined to get there. And on my way there, on my way to the United States, I had a stop in New York City. I decided to visit a friend of mine in New York City who had been here a couple months before me, but he was here. He was like, oh, stop by New York, stay a couple of weeks before making it to Berea, Ohio. And that's what I did. That's what I did.
And you stayed.
And I'm still here.
Oh, that's an amazing story.
Well, I mean, it's a long story, but it's
Have you ever just gone to Berea out of curiosity?
No, but the funny thing is I came with another friend of mine who was in university with me in Dakar, and we were going to the same Berea, and he went, and I stayed. And we have these two parallel lives. We're still very good friends, and we're comparing the.
Does he still live in Berea?
No, he left Berea a long time ago after school.
Berea is a place to leave.
To leave, and he did leave. He left with a woman. He got married, and he got children. Now they live in Switzerland.
Oh, good.
They live in Switzerland, but they work in plastic. You know, he's a chemical engineer, and you know, he's doing things that I'm happy I'm not doing, but he seems content with that. You know, I stayed here because it was a set of circumstances. I lost my money. I got robbed 3 days after I arrived in New York.
So and you didn't leave after that?
I was tempted to leave, go back to Senegal.
Yeah, I would have gotten the first bus out of New York.
Well, the first thing that scared me going back to Senegal was to have to face my father and tell him everything you saved is gone in 3 days because I got robbed. I was in New York. So I was not going back to face my dad. Luckily, I was staying in a really crappy hotel in Times Square. Times Square at the time was not like what you know right now. And so in that hotel, there was a Senegalese community. And it seemed like all the rejects of New York society in that same hotel.
So, how convenient.
Yes. And so it so happened that one of my roommates, I think we were like five or six in that room, and one of them happened to work in a restaurant. And he knew I needed a job now because I had no money. And he offered me this opportunity. He's like, well, we're looking for a busboy in this restaurant in the West Village in Manhattan at the time called Garvin's. And that's where I started. And then I'm
still... It's like the classic immigrant story.
Classic immigrant story, totally.
Had you ever worked in a restaurant before that?
No, it was my first job ever.
Yeah.
First job ever.
I'm just so amazed that you are a chef. Not amazed that you're a chef, but like you really just... It's like that sort of classic like American dream story. Like you just worked your way... Mm-hmm. All the way up. I mean, how did that happen that you started as a busboy and then you opened your first restaurant, Yolele, in Brooklyn in 2001? Mm-hmm. How does one go from being a busboy to opening their own restaurant?
Well, from being a busboy, but being also very interested into food. Coming from Senegal, we are a food culture, a strong food culture in Senegal. So I was always interested into food. Only I couldn't even dream of food as a career because in Senegal, food is a gender-based activity. So men, boys are not allowed in the kitchen.
Is that still the case?
Well, it's changing now. You have lots of male chefs who are interested into cooking, but it's still very, you know, strongly gender-based still you see that. But it's less shocking now to see men are cooking, it's been 2017.
And that's interesting because it's always been the opposite here and it's only now just starting to change.
That's right.
Was that surprising for you to see that dynamic?
That's where I was getting, so I was in Senegal and not knowing that men could be in the kitchen until I'm here in New York City and there's only men in that kitchen. The thing that attracted me the most out of it was that these men were doing some really beautiful food, beautiful plating, and that reminded me of one of my favorite pastime growing up in Senegal was to go through my mother's cookbook collection and looking at the pictures. The pictures were just exactly what these guys at Garvin's were doing. And the chef, Billy, I think he noticed how I was, you know, I was bringing the plates, the dirty plates back in the kitchen, and then I would stay in the kitchen and look at these guys plating this food. And he thought I was like just natural and I was into this. You know, he saw this little kid from Africa and just said, come and I'll take you under my wing. And he did take me under his wing, but started from scratch. Dishwasher from busboy, and I was doing dishwashing shifts. You know, I was, to me in my head, I was like an extra income. You know, I'm going to save enough money and go to Ohio. You know, it's like
every New Yorker's dream.
Every New Yorker's dream. That cowboy's dream for real. It was like, I was really, you know, I was pursuing this thing. I mean, And then I was just into this kitchen thing now. It's like, I mean, dishwashing, I hated every moment of it, but I did it right until I grew to be a prep. And from the prep, I grew to be a garde-manger. And garde-manger, I had like the grill station, from the grill station. I mean, I went through different stations until I left Garvin's to go through another restaurant that was opening at the time by the Hudson River, actually. It was called Amazon. It was opening for the summer. And they needed, sous chefs, a line of sous chefs. And that's when I applied and I got hired. And after this, I was like 3 years later. And, you know, it was a summer restaurant, but I realized that I was into this. And it was not, I was not going back into the campus or physics and chemistry. Food was chemistry already, and I could connect with that. That was the type of chemistry I really could connect with in a better way than the labs. So
that's... So long, Berea.
So long, Berea. No.
So you do so much work now. I mean, you're so many different things. You're a chef, and you're a teacher, and you're an educator, and you do TED Talks, and so much of your work is about educating people about Senegalese food and what that means. Why is that so important to you, to kind of carry your traditions and your heritage with you through the food that you cook here in the United States?
Well, it's important because, especially here in New York, to me, is like the immigrant city, you know. It's like, and working in New York, over the years, I started working in this restaurant in Soho, and that kind of changed my complete path. Because before that, I worked after the American at Garvin's. I worked with Italians, and I worked as French bistros, Jean-Claude. And then I'm arriving at Boom, this place in Soho on Spring Street, and the chef was doing what he would call global ethnic cuisine, and that was completely different. And he was getting inspiration from Southeast Asia, and some North Africans. Just amazing food that kind of reminded me of the food I was used to eating growing up in Senegal.
Yeah, all the crossovers.
All the crossovers. And I'm like, how come New York City don't have African cuisine? At the time, there was no such thing as African cuisine in New York.
Oh, really?
City. No, it's
nothing.
Like nothing really. So, you know, and I knew African. I mean, I knew we had good food. I grew up eating it, and and it could be as same spot as any great cuisines here in New York, great restaurants in New York City. So I started to focus on that, and boom, that restaurant gave me the opportunity because I became a chef de cuisine in the restaurant. The restaurant was doing really well, and they opened a couple of locations, one in the Hamptons and one in South Beach, Miami. So I was sent in South Beach to open that restaurant as a chef. And that's in South Beach that I started to implement slowly like African dishes in the menu. And the reaction was just awesome. People were like, you know, we had great reviews, and that inspired me to keep on getting inspiration from that cuisine. I would call my mom and I would get recipes and I would start writing them down.
Do you remember some of those recipes?
Well, the first time I served Senegalese cuisine in the restaurant was peanut sauce. Actually, it was a vegetarian peanut mafé. It's a peanut sauce, typical, not only Senegalese, but you see it throughout West Africa. So like a really thick, different than the satay sauce, like a really a sauce that comes like in a stew. It could come with lamb or chicken, but that day I served it with vegetables. And a food critic happened to be at the restaurant that day.
Oh.
Just a typical story, right?
Yeah.
It's like my life in New York could be a movie, I guess.
I would love to see that movie.
Yeah, sure, someday. but that's how it started. So that was the dish. But then over the years, I've accumulated recipes, and I realized that I had potential cookbook there, you know. And that was my first cookbook, Yolele. After assembling the recipes, I found this great publisher, Lake Isle Press, who totally saw the potential, even though African cuisine, there was no such thing as African cuisine in the bookstores here. It was mostly like all these other cuisines. So they believed in it, and I had this great friend and photographer, Adam Bartos, who came to Senegal with me a couple of times, and we finished this cookbook. And the cookbook led to the restaurant led to another restaurant and another cookbook and everything I'm doing now.
Yeah. Did you have any of your mother's recipes in that book?
Oh, yeah. Not only I had her recipes, I had my mother's recipes, I had aunt's recipes, grandmother's. As a matter of fact, if you see Yolele, the first cookbook, is photos of food and photos of portraits of women. Because the book was meant to be a tribute to the African women. It's like portraits of all the women of my family, really, like the aunts
beautiful.
And the grandmothers. Because we went to the villages where my father is from and my mother's village. So it's beautiful and colorful. And African women, they love to dress elegantly and colorfully.
So,
so it makes it special.
Well, I know you mentioned you go back and forth a lot, and you're one of the many causes you champion is responsible tourism.
Mm.
What does that mean to you?
Well, responsible tourism is, to me, the kind of tourist who comes to learn from a culture, you know, to have a cultural experience. And there are other ways, other type of tourists that you see who are not coming to... They're not bringing anything. For me, it has to be an exchange, you know. You're not only bringing, of course, you bring your currency, but you have to come with a respectful approach, first of all, a respectful approach to the culture you're visiting, and just the kind there's unfortunately in Africa you'd see it a lot, you know, you have the type of tourism, and I'm coming to food here, where the tourist is not really even exposed to the cuisine, the local cuisine, you know, and they would go to cities like Dakar or Lagos, and they would just easily find French or Italian or even Chinese or Japanese sushi before finding a traditional local African, or even like not doesn't have to be traditional, but African influenced restaurant, and that's to me that's not tourism, you know, it's not traveling. If you're traveling, you don't even experience the food, the local food. You know, you're missing out on a big part of the culture because food is really where it begins. And you know, visiting markets, you know, but some tourists just come and they stay in resorts, you know, and that's you know, can be anywhere. You know, it's like you're not even into that culture. You're not even visiting that country. You know, and also you have the worst parts, you know, those who are like sex predators. You have a lot of that in Africa, you know. You have like, you know, pedophiles. And I mean, all those, you know, things that have none to do with the show, but that has to do with responsible tourism. And you see that we're not only the one, not the only one having that problem. You have it in other parts of the world as well, but it's very prominent in Africa.
How are you addressing those issues?
Well, it's different. There are different ways of addressing it. I talk about it whenever I get a chance. You know, I talk about it with hospitality professionals, you know, to bring that awareness and to also just like champion local food, you know. So that's one way to do it. I've collaborated quite a few years with an organization called African Travel Association, and that's a group of tourism professionals from the airline industry to the hotel industry to the restaurant industry. And every year they would have like like a forum in a city in Africa, and that would be for me an opportunity to talk about promoting local cuisine and offering it to the tourists and offering them that experience and just giving them a whole package, as opposed to just like letting the tour operators who don't even oftentimes don't even have a connection with the culture or the country because they're from the West and they invested their money and they think they just can come and offer an experience that's similar to the one they would offer to you in Switzerland or something like that. And that's completely two different worlds, and that defeats the purpose. I think when you travel, you're traveling to really experience the culture and to travel. So that's one way of addressing it. I'm addressing it by also being here and representing my culture in New York City, in America, in the West, and in many ways through my food again, through my books. You know, my books are very much more than cookbooks. They're not a collection of recipes. They give you the like my last book is called From the Source to the Bowl. You know, the source. You know, so I travel throughout the country and meet producers and give a voice to those producers so that the reader understands where that food is coming from. It's not just a picture of beautiful plates when it's finished, but before, how did that plate come to be? Those ingredients, how did they get here? This fish, what's the fisherman's life, you know? And doing that, I present this fisherman and he talks about his challenges. And you in New York City reading it, you connect with that fisherman in Senegal, in Dakar, and you know that, you know, he's really stressed out because the way he had, he was used to have lots of fish. Senegal is like a fishing country by excellence, but it's challenged now because, you know, you have other bigger countries are coming right by water and they do illegal fishing and they rake the bottom of the ocean in a very unethical way, destroy the coral reef. And the fisherman in my cookbook, his name is Usman, is like completely desperate now. He's like, okay, I have to start thinking about a new way of making a living. And that's another story now, but a new way of making a living for him is to be smuggling immigrants to Spain. In those wooden canoes from Senegal to Spain. I mean, mind you, those guys, they know the water, they're masters of the water, but those canoes are not designed to go to Spain, you know. Spain is like the closest coast in Europe for them, and once they get to Spain, they can enter and go wherever they want. And people pay lots of money to risk their lives to make it to Spain. And regardless of the news that many people never make it, people drown, still people are willing to go. And this fisherman knows that by just making one trip with a full boat, he'll be making enough money, more money than he would have made in the whole life of it, whole year of fishing. So that's that's the kind of information you would get in reading my cookbook. You know, you would get recipes around the fish that he caught, but more than that, you would have in-depth information about the lifestyle. And,
I mean, do you ever feel torn to go back, or do you just feel like there's so much more you can do here, just kind of shining a light on stories like the one you just shared?
Well, I feel like to me, ideally would be to be in both places, clone myself, right? Or, but I do feel need to go back. I do go back quite often. Actually, I go back 4 or 5 times a year for short trips, but I do go back. But I would love to spend half my life there, half life here. When it's cold here, I hate the cold. When it's cold here, I'll be in Senegal and then back in New York, because I love New York. I mean, Dakar see, is a fundamental place for me, but New York is really the city where I lived the most of my life. And so I'm as much a New Yorker as from a Dakar.
And a little bit of Berea.
A little bit of Berea.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Chef Pierre Chiam.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I've been in studio chatting with my most lovely guest, Chef Pierre Thiem, who is from Senegal. Chef, you're someone who, in almost every sense of the word, just you're embodied kind of the American dream. You know, you came to the United States as an immigrant. You started as a busboy in a restaurant, and you worked your way all the way up. How do you feel now as someone who's been living here, you know, for a long time but, you know, still very much identify as someone who is from Senegal, kind of witnessing what's happening with all of the anti-immigration sentiment coming from the top, like especially towards DACA recipients, like people like you who came here at kind of a young age and are just trying to make it?
Wow, it's, I don't even know what words could just express this feeling. It's really coming from a place where I was there. You know, I was there.
Mm-hmm,
I was. You know, I came here with a, like I say, with a student visa, but then I didn't make it to school. Then my status has changed, and I was illegal. I was one of those illegal immigrants, and New York never made me feel like this. Mm. You know, at the time I was illegal, but I could function. I could make a honest living. I was paying taxes at some point. I was able to get a restaurant to sponsor me for halfway through, you know, and then I got lucky because I won the green card. Dream life, right?
Oh, wow.
I won the green card.
You've had so much, I mean, incredible circumstances.
Both a movie.
Yeah, yeah. I hope there's movie producers listening to the show right now.
Hey, yeah, okay. You get a percentage.
In only in the sense that you've had such incredible luck that there just might be that person listening. If it were to happen, it would be because of you.
It would be Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, of course. He's a fan.
Okay. So yeah, that's what happened. I won the green card by just putting my name. At the time, it was so easy to you put your name, your address, your country of origin, and in an envelope, and you send it, something like this, something as simple as that. And then a month or two later, I received this big envelope saying, congratulations.
The golden ticket.
Yeah, and I'm like, wait a minute, I don't even need the restaurant to sponsor me for my working permit anymore. And the timing was perfect, because the restaurant, actually, its timing was couldn't be better, because the restaurant was growing, that was boom already. And we were invited to an event in Italy, actually, to do an event that was connected with Slow Food. Slow Food was just starting at the time, and they had somehow invited us. I don't know how we got selected, us and another chef in Miami. And we were going to do a dinner for the media at a place. It was Slow Food, but it wasn't really Slow Food event. It was a wine fair called Vinitalia in Verona. And I wouldn't be able to go if I didn't have a green card, because even the work permit wasn't allowing me to do that. And so, you know, I got my green card, and then 2 weeks later, I was my way to Italy, returned from Italy. The following month, I went to Senegal, first time in 7 years. Wow. So I stayed 7 years before I was able to go back to Senegal. I've seen people who stayed even longer, 20 plus years, and who haven't made it back to their country. And those people who are there at the time, it was okay, because there was still some hope. There was not like that feeling that you get now. I mean, like where the head of the country himself is like just targeting you.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, at the time we didn't have that. We felt support. We knew that we were playing a role in the economy, and it was made clear by definitely New York City, the government, the mayor was all supportive of like immigrants and facilitating our, you know, our legalization. So here you don't feel that anymore, and I think it eventually it's going to backfire if this continues, because immigrants play a major role in cities like New York City, but at large in the United States, immigrants' contribution is immense, you know, and people are being blind to this today. It's unfortunate.
Well, you're a prime example of the just invaluable contributions that people from all over the world are making once they come here. Speaking of one of the many things that you're doing, I watched a TED Talk that you gave, which was really incredible, about fonio, which is it's an ancient grain. It's indigenous to the part of Africa and Senegal that you come from. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what that is, why you chose to give a TED Talk about it?
Why I chose to give a TED Talk about it is one of the many hats I wear is I studied a line of products. And to me, I always wanted to, as you saw in the TED Talk, I always wanted to contribute, you know, not just come and take, you know. And I think that's what all immigrants in general do. They take and they receive and they give too, you know. So for me, contribution was, okay, I wanted to start a line of products. I'm about food. I wanted to introduce this food culture, which is mine. That's why I wrote those books. That's why I opened the restaurants. And now I want to reach a wider audience. And by doing so, if I could introduce products, the way we're eating, our food culture. And fonio, this grain, is like the first step, the entryway to that. But the dream is to really introduce an African pantry to this world, to America. And fonio, why fonio? Because fonio has it all for it. You know, it's like it's a typical ingredient that conscious consumers in this part of the world are hip to. You know, it's gluten free, it's protein rich, it's delicious, it cooks fast, it's versatile. You can do so many things with it. You know, turn it into flour, then pasta. I make salads with it. You know, and it's just delicious. You know,
and I like that you said in the TED Talk, it's easier to say than quinoa.
It is easier to say than quinoa.
It is, yeah.
And quinoa is doing all that, you know.
Quinoa's so doing great.
Quinoa is the inspiration here. So,
yeah.
You know, so we bracing and we fighting to take fonio to that level.
Yeah.
For many reasons, you know, the impact that the success of fonio would have in the communities back home. So again, you know, it's like bringing here, but also bringing back home. You know, the communities that grow fonio are the poorest in West Africa. Fonio grows in poor soil. It's like a drought-resistant grain that grows really fast, that matures like in 2 months. So it's quite an amazing grain, a miracle grain in a way, you know. Culturally, too, fonio is very, very important in the communities that grow it. You know, like growing up in Senegal, you know, in the south of Senegal, where my parents are from, you know, there's a belief that when you grow fonio in your backyard, you know, it protects you from the evil eye. So and kids sometimes, I even put some fonio grains into their school bags for that same reason. Again, I mentioned in the TED Talk about how archaeologists have discovered fonio in burial grounds in ancient Egypt. So even ancient Egyptians would go to the afterlife with fonio grains. So in many cultures, fonio in West Africa and in parts of Africa where it was consumed, fonio is more than just a food ingredient. It's an ingredient that has miracle properties.
But the goal is to start exporting it.
The goal is to start exporting it, and we have started exporting it already. So fonio actually is available at Whole Foods Harlem today, and we are setting the marketing campaign to expand in the northeast region of Whole Foods in 40 stores.
Wow.
And we are at Amazon since 2 days ago now. So fonio is exported.
And that's important because it's supporting farmers. It's supporting
people
who are, I guess, operating the fonio mills back in Senegal. It's creating jobs.
Exactly.
It's improving the agriculture by growing it in this efficient way.
Yep. And also climate change mitigation as well, because it's growing in the desert in the south of the Sahara. So it's the only grain that, one of the rare grains that can grow there. It not only grows there, it thrives there. You know, it's just a, so that's why we're importing it in collaboration with communities. You know, it's like a fair trade deal. It's not just like a private thing. So we improve those lives by opening markets to them and markets that are just completely unreachable before.
So we want to go to Whole Foods and buy Fonio.
We want to go to Whole Foods and buy Yolele Fonio.
Yolele. Oh, yeah. Like your cookbook.
Absolutely, Yolele, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
One thing that kind of stuck with me, though, when during the TED Talk is you spoke about how some Senegalese people were sort of resistant to the idea of promoting it because there's this kind of stigma attached to like homegrown crops not being as appealing as ones that might be coming from the Western world.
Yeah, yeah, those are the sequels of colonialism. Mm. I mean, unfortunately, we still have that mentality. And cities like Dakar, you wouldn't find, or you can find, but it's difficult to find Fonio because the Dakar people are, you know, westernized, you know,
right.
And they look down. We still import our rice, you know, and we have local rice, but people resist the local rice.
And perfect conditions for growing it, yeah.
Perfect conditions for growing it. And we have other grains, millet, which is another great grain, you know, Fonio, sorghum, you know, those grains are there, but you only see them consumed in the country, you know. And at Dakar, the city people, they look at them as like country people grains, country people food, you know. It's like, and we eat croissants and baguettes. We don't grow wheat in Senegal, but we make great baguette bread. Every day, Senegalese eat baguettes, at least for breakfast, every day. I mean, there's like millions of tons of flour.
Those leftover shades of the French colonization.
Exactly, exactly. So that's that mentality that we have to fight. That's the challenge, you know. So bringing.
Well, I so admire what you're doing to change that.
Thank you.
And I will buy all the Fonio.
Great.
And tell my friends.
Please.
So tell us where we can keep in touch with you. Learn about going on your trips to Senegal that you lead.
Mm-hmm.
Learn about your catering company. Where can we keep in touch? Keep tabs on you.
Well, there's many ways. I have a website, my first and last name, pierrecham.com. My food brand is called Yolele. So we have a website for that too, yolelefoods.com. Yolele is Yolele, foods.com. And there you can get all the information on where to get Fonio, how to cook Fonio, recipes and everything. On my website, I'll give you all the information about my upcoming trips, the culinary tour that we are doing again. We studied the tradition in collaboration with Boston University. There's a West African Research Center that's affiliated to Boston University. And every year now we're taking a group to Senegal on a culinary tour from February 1st to February 10th. And I hope you can join us. It's going to be an amazing tour. We travel. Not only we go to the source, we meet with fishermen, we follow how the fish is being transformed, you know, the conch, how the conch is being fermented. You see all these things, how the smoked fish, the fish is being smoked traditionally by the water. We have this sardine-looking fish, you know, that we call yaboy or ketcher, and we smoke it by the water. And it's just an amazing experience. And we spend time with women processing grains like fonio or millet and turning it into couscous and cooking and eating, of course, and visiting a lot of markets. And it's just like overall great experience.
It sounds amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chef, for coming on the show. It was such an absolute delight to have you. Thank you out there for listening. We'll see you next week, same time, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.